I was just reading for enjoyment this afternoon some reviews, contemporary reception of Lord of the Rings from the mid to late 50s when it was first published. And of course, one of his most... I don't think Tolkien really cared a lot about what most people thought about it in academia. He knew he was a serious philologist, but I think his ego was wounded by a few people, especially Wilson, before Comic-Con and an exalted level of nerddom was considered acceptable. A lot of serious voices said these fairy stories is just juvenile trash. And I start there because I want to explain to you, I want to discuss from, based on Tolkien's letters, why he's writing what he's writing, and then sort of open that up into, you know, the contemporary church and what the church sees as its mission today in the church. So I'm going to assume that most of you know who Tolkien is, and I'm not going to even look at a section that I wrote up about his life. Is that okay? Okay. If you have a problem, I'll just give this to... I mean, we know the man. We've seen pictures of him with his pipe. Inklings mean something to some of you. Okay, all right. I figured that would be the case, but I just want to start in a historically responsible way. So to sort of jump into what Tolkien thought he was doing, if I had to summarize his intellectual personality, it would have to do with words. By profession and by habitus, Tolkien was a philologist. If you look at the first quotation, those of you who actually have my very small font handout, he said, give me a name and it makes a story. In a letter he wrote in 1951, he says, I do not remember a time when I was not building languages. Many children make up or begin to make up imaginary languages. I have been at it since I could write. Behind my stories is now a nexus of languages. The two languages of the elves are deduced scientifically from a common origin. Out of these languages are made nearly all the names that appear in my legends. This gives a certain character, a cohesion, an illusion of historicity to the nomenclature. So for Tolkien, in a lot of his letters affirm this, a word and especially a name already bears within itself the fullness of the story, its integrity within the complex web of a whole language's history. Addresses the need of our imagination to be drawn into a world that is compelling, that is plausible. Tolkien's sense of his project as a mythological and imaginative entry into what he considers to be simply true is the central theme of my presentation tonight. The power of story to be revelatory and the power of words to be incarnational. I'm going to bring some focus to this big picture approach by talking about Tolkien's realism, and I'm going to do this by focusing on two particular ways I see his realism at work in Lord of the Rings. First, his historical realism, and then second, his moral visionary realism. And then finally, my concluding remarks after sort of going over these many letters where he says, there's really just one story to tell, and I'm going to tell you that story in one form. I'll just say a few words about what is the indisputable central truth of the perennial human story, which is the story of temptation, fall, and redemption. Okay? All right, so buckle up, hobbits. So why fairy stories? I mean, this is really the question, right? I mean, given this kind of a response to what Tolkien was doing. I'll get myself in order here. Tolkien loved Beowulf, texts like Beowulf. And it's fair to ask, did he imagine that he was writing another Beowulf for a contemporary audience? Tolkien was deeply concerned that modern man, and woman, was losing the ability to see and live in what is truly real. And for Tolkien, what is real is summed up under the idea of history as real events. For Tolkien, history is something vital, living, and personal, and historical consciousness involves a complex interplay of memory and hope, a living tension between presentness and transcendence. So if you take a look at the second quotation on that handout, you know, consider how easy it would be for Wilson and others to look at the Inklings and say, oh, these Oxford natives, they just couldn't handle the darkness of modernity, so they just hid in a romantic Oxford pub with large pints of beers. And, you know, we could accuse them of an unreasonable kind of traditionalism or primitivism. Tolkien often wrote in response to this in a strong kind of rejection. He said, he states that he writes to restore cultural memory. And he also has a very lively sense of the limits of historical research as a tool for providing easy answers to contemporary problems. So if you look at your quotation there, when he critiques what he calls primitivism as a return to some timeless and authentic form in the church, he writes, "The church was not intended by our Lord to be static or to remain in perpetual childhood, but to be a living organism likened to a plant which develops and changes in externals by the interaction of its bequeathed divine life and history, the particular circumstances of the world into which it is set. There is no resemblance between the mustard seed and the full-grown tree." Sorry about that. So Tolkien really did not return moderately traumatized from the war to rewrite the English national myth or to take refuge in an Oxford pub. He claimed after the war to see humanity in a clearer light than ever before, and the charge he made against modernity was one of forgetting. Forgetting what it is to be human, forgetting the demands of nature, forgetting the reality of evil, and forgetting what truly humane progress looks like. Okay, but still you should be asking, why then write a fairy story to make this clear? So Tolkien, I'd argue, is committed to an aesthetic. I have been reading Von Balthasar, but he's committed to an aesthetic way of telling as revelation. And I use the word aesthetic because Tolkien is very clear that good storytelling should reach the whole person. Okay, it should speak to the mind, the intellectual dimension, and it should speak to the heart, the affective dimension. Teaching or telling that only addresses the mind will fail to form the imagination. And for Tolkien, imagination, the heart, and its related faculty of memory is the way into the whole person. And this reflects the understanding of the human person you find in the paragraphs in the Catechism around 350 to 360s. Tolkien is well known for rejecting allegory as a way of writing a story. And there's at least two reasons why he dissed allegory. This caused a little bit of tension between him and C.S. Lewis. Tolkien insisted that as a storyteller, he's interested in truth, but accessed through what he calls exemplification. That is through narrative, language, the particular interest of individual characters. Second, he argues that allegory is too much like a technique, like a tool, using words as instruments to say something, thereby approximating something he particularly dreaded, being preachy. Not the same thing as preaching, but being preachy. And he says the problem with being preachy is that he's not saying I don't have something to say, but rather this mode of saying renders the hearer to be overly passive and receptive, rather than actively, searchingly present and involved in a story. And you all have this experience when you get involved in a good story. But much more importantly, it is the nature of truth itself, Tolkien says, to have a life of its own that stands before us and over against us and even commands us and strikes us with its moral brilliance. For this reason, Tolkien often said, and look at the third quotation in your handout, he often said that he was not creating a story as though from his own resources, but he was discovering it. In a letter from 1951, he writes, "The stories arose in my mind as given things, and as they came separately, so too the links grew. I always had the sense of recording what was already there somewhere, and not of inventing." The truths that he finds in writing myths reflect and contain, I'm quoting again a letter of his, "they reflect and contain in solution elements of moral and religious truth or error. Indeed, he's only interested in perennial truths about humanity, as they are evidenced by the same pattern that recurs over and over again throughout history." But Tolkien says, if you find and identify these truths, they should never be presented in the explicit or in the form of the primary real world. It's precisely the tension between the true and what is unreal or imaginatively unfamiliar, short guys with hairy feet, that constitutes the great didactic possibility of story. It strikes and then awakens the imagination of the reader and then draws one with pleasure into what is patterned therein. And if this seems like a strip, maybe it doesn't seem like a strange way to enter into this story, but that idea of a tension between the way something is presented and the substance of it is something that recurs to me teaching undergraduates over and over again. So in our first, actually in our second theology class, we talk of the two that are required. We read De Verbum, we talk about Revelation, and really it's sort of a reading the New Testament kind of course, okay? But reading the Bible is really hard. The first course is an Old Testament course, okay? And trying to help students see that they have to read it like a book, in a sense, at the same time as reading it as somehow divinely inspired. And that means they have to pay attention to genre, to history, to tradition. That's really hard. So, you know, I read with students last semester the Book of Job, which I will probably never do again. Another professor read Hosea. He said, I'll never do that again. I said, look, you know, when you read this, or let's say you go into the Gospels and, you know, the kingdom of God is like a mustard seed. Okay. Is this true? I asked students, is this true? And they sense, like, they sense that there's a trap. Okay, is this true? Well, okay, it's an allegory, so no, it's not true. And then I ask them, because I could never come up with a better example, is Tolkien's Fellowship of the Ring true? They say, oh no, of course not. Its genre is fantasy. Okay, but then they feel, again, like they've been sort of trapped in a corner somehow, because then I ask them, are the events portrayed within a book like Fellowship of the Ring, the story of evil, of temptation, of moral victory, of brokenness, is that story true? They know they have to say yes, but they have no idea how to account for that answer. Okay. And what I feel like I'm often getting at in attempting to teach scripture, which I have no professional qualification at all to teach, except in the way Augustine does, is that, and this is getting, I'm trying to illustrate sort of Tolkien's anxiety about modern persons, is that the moral imagination has become so thin. Our children are taught so young to take everything they learn and put it into two columns: facts, the things they can measure, and everything else, which are values in the realm of mere subjectivity. This is the stuff that's true. We don't really know what to do with all the other stuff in the other column or the pile of ideas. And I find with students that they have so little just experience with reading, this is unfair somewhat, that we all evidence Tolkien's concern about a sort of thinness of moral imagination. This is exactly what Tolkien is doing when he chooses to write a fairy story to help modern persons to see the real world in all of its beauty and all of its glory again. I hope that makes sense as a kind of illustration. I can talk about more that a little bit more later, my ways of confounding my own students. So, but just coming back again to some last remarks on Tolkien's own sense of this project, when he rejects allegory, when he says, I am writing truth, in a sense, by writing this crazy stuff, okay, he's very clear. You can look at the fourth quotation in your handout. He says, there's really only one story worth telling, and it's the story of life. He admits that allegory will be an element of any good story, insofar as the question of meaning is always present to us. But he says, quote, the only perfectly consistent allegory is a real life. The two just start out from opposite ends. He says in another letter, make the ring into an allegory of our times, of the fate of those who seek to defeat power with power. But this is only effective if power actually works in this way in all times. You cannot write a story about an apparently simple magic ring without that question bursting in. If you take the ring really seriously and make things happen that would happen if such a thing existed. The net effect of myth, according to C.S. Lewis, is that it takes the things that we know and restores to them the rich significance which has been hidden by the veil of familiarity. As long as the story lingers in our minds, the real things are more themselves. Okay, the second stage or element of mythological truth-telling is precisely the power or effectiveness that comes from the internal coherence of a story. This is a necessary element, and it resonates with my own, you know, work on this distinction that Augustine Thomas makes between the idea that things have natures in themselves vested in their form, their sort of species identity, but far more important, in a sense, is the systemic functionality of the cosmos on the whole. So in a good story, things act the way they ought to act, but much more important to our moral imagination is that they act the way that they do in the context of this compelling whole. This is absolutely necessary. And again, to cite Tolkien, he says, I don't know if this quotation is there, He writes, if one, because many people said, not only is this is juvenile trash, like it is just for little, stupid little kids, okay? And he writes somewhat sarcastically in response, if one sets out to address adults, mentally adult people anyway, they will not be pleased, excited, or moved unless the whole, the incident, seem to be about something that is worth considering. More, for example, than mere danger and escape, there must be some relevance to the human situation of all periods. Which I have to say, as an aside, it's a damningly apt description of a lot of popular YA literature today. It's very hard to care. It's my own opinion, though. I don't want to offend anyone. But this also suggests a third and final, perhaps obvious aspect of narrative truth-telling for Tolkien, that it is actually relevant. Every narrative, he says, is a pattern with its proper coherence, held together for Tolkien by these linkages of language, calendars, prehistories, prophetic foreshadowings. But each element of this pattern is just one example of what Tolkien calls capital T, capital P, the pattern. If you look at 4b, also under number 4 in your handout, what he says is the eternally truthful story of human history, as I've already said, of creation, fall, and redemption, which is only definitively revealed and made known in the incarnation, life, and resurrection of, in the person of Jesus Christ, our Lord. So this is what Tolkien says, the story of all stories is the resurrection. It is the dramatic new catastrophe. Okay, so all of this, I'm going to move on now, but I just want to make sure that everyone has a sense of, in Tolkien's own words, especially from his letters, just why he's doing what he's doing, and how he sees his writing as a way of saying something, something that is true, but in a way that is very pedagogically interesting, really complicated. Okay. All right, so if I'm right, and because I'm saying this, I do think that I'm right, I think Tolkien says this very clearly, that he does not just want to access some truth about the human condition, but that he is specifically writing to restore to modern persons the ability to see things as they really are. I want to argue, just show how this plays out in Lord of the Rings by sort of two general approaches. Okay, I've already said that I want to talk about the idea of naturalism, and I'm going to talk about naturalism in two forms so that it becomes clear what I mean. The first is historical naturalism. The second is visionary moral naturalism. So by naturalism, you could understand realism, perhaps. Okay, different ways that Tolkien wants us to not just enter into, be struck by a great story and its compelling truths and characters, but ultimately, through the story, sort of come back to what's right in front of me. Okay, so first, historical naturalism. You can find so many really interesting nerdy websites where you see different people trying to handle the geography and the chronology of Middle Earth. And Tolkien clearly wanted to suggest some crossover possible linkages with modern day Europe, but he also puts things in there deliberately to also complexify our ability to do that. There is some plausibility in linking Gondor to either Constantinople or Germany in the 20th century. But the only historical, or the only geographical connection that Tolkien himself legitimates is that between the Shire and rural England, which is situated precisely the latitude of Oxfordshire. So the story of Lord of the Rings, very importantly, ends in the Shire, since the memory of home has been the most potent form of memory and grace that has been motivating the Hobbit characters after they have set off on their quest. So a few examples of how Tolkien links the history of his work to our history. First of all, in the Marshes of the Dead and the Two Towers, we read in that book that the journey. I'm just going to quote the text a lot here, interspersed with my own commentary here. We read that the journey was a shadow of growing fear in which memory could find nothing to rest upon. Particularly for Frodo, as he gets farther and farther away from the Shire, he loses a sense of time. He's described as, quote, hovering between sleep and waking until forgetfulness comes over him completely. As both Sam and Frodo approach Mordor, a, quote, land of darkness, of course, they lose their sense of time and memory. Here, the world itself seems, quote, forgotten, and all who enter here are forgotten too. At the penultimate moment, very close to despair, Frodo cries out, "This blind darkness seems to be getting into my heart. As I lay in prison, I tried to remember the Brandywine River. I can't see anything now. As Frodo moves towards the fulfillment of his task, and again, I'm assuming everyone knows exactly what I'm talking about, that either you've read it, or you've seen the films, or you're going to run out and read it as soon as I'm done. So as Frodo moves towards fulfillment of his task, he sees and senses nothing except what he calls the Wheel of Fire. He says all else fades before his eyes. A common battle cry for the hobbits as they set off is, "For the Shire!" And the true hero for them, always, just like Odysseus, is ultimately motivated by a desire to come home and restore order, life, and joy in the most mundane and familiar context. So the point I'm making here that Tolkien emphasized in his letters is that, in a way, all the ending scenes in the Shire, which are way too long in the films, seem a little bit tacked on in a way. Tolkien always intended that to be the necessary, and in a way, the central, sort of completion, let's say, of the work that they were doing. So the memory that they lose as they go forward also carries them back home. But the Shire is, it's England. It's rural England. It's, you know, it's New Haven. There's a more subtle literary way in which Tolkien moves the reader from a kind of mythological time to historical time that asks us to think, maybe all this elvish stuff is, maybe Middle Earth really is Earth, okay? If you compare the fairy stories from the first page, if you've ever looked at the Silmarillion, the stories from the first age, they read a lot like moving from Genesis 1 through 11 to Genesis 12. Kind of like moving from a sort of mythological prehistory to history, okay? The Valaquenta, effectively the creation epic, is worded in the present tense, describing a timeless or instantaneous set of events. It is only when you enter the Silmarillion itself that we have a beginning of something like historical time that is more familiar to us. Even if time is very mythological in character, time begins with the creation of the two trees of Valinor, which marks the true beginning of the first day, with the opening hour and the newly established cycle of 12-hour days. So this first age, time begins with it, but this age ends, very interestingly, with the creation of the moon and the sun, which are also come rather late in Genesis 1, 2, even though they're supposedly the markers of time. But at the same time, this opening age also contains the story of the making of the Silmarils, these great jewels that are fabricated in order to contain the light of these two great trees. So finally, the first age also includes the awakening of men and focuses on the mischief of Morgoth and the love story of Beren, Lúthien, so on and so forth. But it's really in the transition from the first age to the second age where we have something more like familiar historical time that gets going. By the end of the, we have the War of Elves and Men against Sauron, setting up for the action of Lord of the Rings directly. By the end of the Third Age, and that's where the action of Lord of the Rings is situated, by the end of the Third Age, which is really brought to a close with the destruction of the One Ring, which happens incidentally on March the 25th, which you all know is the Feast of the Annunciation, okay? We find ourselves back at a Shire which is rather familiar to us. So there's all these different layers with a different feeling of time in them, a kind of mythological prehistory, a sort of narrative history, then a more kind of historical time that feels familiar. And then we end up at the end of it all with Sam getting back home, plopping a child in his lap saying, "Well, I'm back. Just like another day. Time to go farming and get a little dirt under my..." It's so banal. It's so ordinary. That's exactly what Tolkien wants. It's like, okay, you're back. Okay, so that memory of home, again, that has sustained the hobbits right to the end, suggests what is the truly real thing of importance. This saga of destruction at the heroic level of Gondor versus Mordor now has to be played out in their own neighborhood. Thus, Frodo, upon their return, exclaims, "This is Mordor." And then Gandalf reminds the hobbits, because he's not going with them. He says goodbye. If you look at number 5 on your handout, he says, "I'm not coming with you." And they're upset. They're like, "Wait, you're supposed to fix everything, right?" He says, "I'm not coming. You must settle its affairs for yourselves. This is what you have been trained for. Do you not yet understand? My time is over. It is no longer my task to set things to rights. You will need no help. You are grown up now." It's just so reminiscent of of Jesus, you know, speaking to the apostles, especially after the resurrection. It's like, stop fishing. I've given you everything you need, you idiots. I mean, and Gandalf is not that. I mean, he doesn't really say that. But Gandalf is warm and he's paternal, but he's like, you're ready. You have everything you need. And again, for us as readers, we're supposed to hear this and think, yes, you're grown up now. I am grown up now. We have to move from the mythical song of creation. We have to understand the pattern of evil and redemption and the faded echoes of that pattern in our history. And then once we enter the homey littleness of Silliman, is that how you pronounce it, college, right? We're supposed to wake up and grow up morally and spiritually and realize that we are implicated in the same pattern of history and must take responsibility for writing it in the place that we work and live. So just the second way that we, I mean, so there's this historical realism, different ways that Tolkien wants to move from the mythological to the present. I also want to just say a little bit about how Tolkien's sense of visionary and moral naturalism. So I use the phrase grow up, and that's exactly what Gandalf says. Like, you have been being prepared for this. We see in all sorts of ways, there's a lot of light imagery, vision imagery, just drenched. The Lord of the Rings is drenched in this. The characters, as they progress, specifically the hobbits, we see that their vision, their perspective shifts as they move on. And in a sense, this is completely predictable. It's their first time out of the neighborhood. But at certain times, Tolkien uses language to signal that it's not, there's something more than just a normal, you know, increase in understanding going on, that they're really coming to see things in a new way. If you look at the quotation 6, most of the significant characters are introduced in a veiled and cryptic manner. It seems like an unnecessary complication. For example, we meet Aragorn, the destined king of Gondor, as announced by a cryptic note left behind by Gandalf through the reported speech of a tavern keeper. He's introduced as Strider. On the other hand, all right, so Strider, on the other hand, looks at Frodo, who doesn't, he's just suspicious and he notices his muddy boots. But Strider is described as looking at Frodo as if he had heard or guessed all. And then in the next few pages, Tolkien keeps coming back to his keen eyes and this sense that he has a knowledge that he has to impart to the hobbits, but he can't yet impart it to them. And when the hobbits get mad at him and charge him for wrongfully concealing his identity as, you know, a friend of Gandalf, he replies, "I needed you hobbits to trust me without proof. They must, in effect, take the risk to come and see before the clarity that they wish to have is granted." So the hobbits are being invited not just to blind trust, but they have to take some action. They have to move. And they have to overcome the deceptive initial appearance that does eventually give way as they speak with him to reveal Aragorn's true nobility of character. So this is not an unusual literary technique to use, but not only are Tolkien's characters, a common criticism from Wilson and others were that these are puerile, asinine, one-dimensional figures. Not only, I think, is that manifestly incorrect, but Tolkien does use to great effect this technique of us learning. It really does take us like a full book or two to really understand the complexity of, for example, Aragorn's motivation. That's just one example. But the pairing of moral growth with visionary insight really does touch on what a lot of scholars or many people, writers, use this phrase, Bishop Barron, for example, which is Tolkien's sacramental worldview. Now, I usually avoid this term because I find it extremely vague, but I do think it gets nicely at the central point about what Tolkien is doing here, with a sense of the dynamic clarity of vision that is the subjective or human correlative to this revelatory conception of history and nature. So how this moral subjective vision is developing, you know, on the one hand, we could talk about nature, we could talk about the art and craft of the elves. True art is a beautifying of nature as it is found. It's a stewardship, it's not an obscuring of it. But I prefer to stay with how particular characters are handled. I think Gandalf is an excellent example of this, better than Aragorn. So Gandalf is a character who really sets the story in motion, as you know. But he tends to arrive at key moments and then disappear almost immediately. Okay. Tolkien does describe Middle-earth as inhabited by many different kinds of embodied rational creatures. And wizards in Middle-earth function as angelic beings. They're described as messengers, mediators, but they're also creatures, so like angels, they have limited insight. All right, so when Bilbo considers leaving the ring behind to Frodo with the rest of his possessions, Peter Jackson exaggerates somewhat the wizard-like force that Gandalf uses to finally force Bilbo to release the ring. Okay, if you look at the text, and I'm not actually think it's a beautiful film, honestly. If you look at the text, Bilbo is angry and suspicious. Why does Gandalf care about this ring? He assumes that Gandalf wants it for himself, so there's a sort of suspicion and envy arising. And Gandalf does threaten to reveal Gandalf the Grey Uncloaked. We have no sense from the book that Bilbo's ability to leave the ring behind in the end is motivated by anything other than humble respect for the power, something he just does not understand, affection for Gandalf and Frodo, and finally, good plain hobbit sense. So Gandalf's majesty throughout all three of the books is always described as veiled, and he knows that he is concealed, what he really is, in a sense. He characterizes himself, for example, to Denethor, the steward of Gondor, as himself being merely a steward, a servant. And every time he gives a rousing speech to the men of Rohan and the men of Gondor, they always say, "Oh, you're back again. Every time you come, you have nothing but bad news." And he says, "That's because I only come when you need to hear the bad news." Okay? And he says, "I only come when help is needed, and I come for counsel." But otherwise, he stays out of the affair of men and hobbits, except for friendship. As a kind of antecedent and cooperative principle of grace, Gandalf consistently puts the burden of responsibility on the characters in the book who are the primary actors in the Third Age. So in Gondor, for example, he advises and he exhorts, "Courage now will be your best defense." And after the devastation of Isengard, he deflects praise. Look at number 7 on your handout. He deflects praise of his great might and wizardry. And he says instead, "If so, I have not shown it yet. I have but given good counsel in peril and made use of the speed of Shadowfax. Your own valor has done more." And bizarrely, his listeners, the text goes on to say, his listeners gazed on Gandalf with still greater wonder in response to these words. So Gandalf's role is not so elusive and magical as it might at first seem. He is a messenger of good and ill tidings. Thus he reveals things as they are. He's also a mediator of good things, bringing disparate people together to draw out from them the best potencies, capacities that they have, and often indeed to redeem one another, as I think is most beautifully seen in what happens between Boromir and Merry and Pippin towards the end of their life. So magic, as we might call it, which would be like deus ex machina or dominating everything, magic doesn't move the story at all. It does not interrupt it. In fact, magic is, disappointingly to my young children, hardly present at all. Why doesn't he do something awesome and fix it all? Okay? The characters, like Gandalf, who embody magic, are clearly servants to the narrative direction. So instead of saying that Tolkien is, you know, offering a kind of visionary realism by this sacramental worldview, I think it's more accurate to say that Tolkien attains narrative realism through making characters to be what Thomas Aquinas would call effective secondary causes in the historical order. They do what they have to do with limited insight, and they just do the best that they can. So some of you might get mad, but I guess if, as an aside, I contrast here Harry Potter. No, it's just mostly too young. Okay, I think that the author of those books, which I don't know particularly well, goes for gestures of imaginative connection by both familiar locations. Hey, that's King's Cross. But also things that are familiar more generally, like the phenomenon of the English boarding school. But it's still worth observing, as far as I can tell, that all the central narrative events in Harry Potter involve or are explained by the non-rules, that is, to a muggle, the non-rules of a parallel universe that I have no access to. Okay, I'm not saying it doesn't make for a great book, okay? But that's a magic universe that I have no access to. But again, in Lord of the Rings, by contrast, there's actually very little magic. in that sense. And in the conversation between Galadriel and I think it's maybe Sam or Frodo, she says, oh yes, this is what you call magic. That concept doesn't really work for us. Like, what you call magic is nature for us. Very interesting. In a really unusual letter to his son, Tolkien talks about miracles and nature, again, in a very Thomistic way. He says, in a sense, the magical or the miraculous is simply a revelation of how nature really works. Miracles seem to be intrusions upon the everyday and the real, when in fact they offer a glimpse that is actually a ray of light through the very chinks of the universe around us. It is like seeing, of course, that's how things really work, with the sensation of being convinced by reason, but without actually reasoning. It's a very complicated sentence. But Tolkien's point there is that the causality of historical events will always be complex, maybe even inscrutable. But what makes the story compellingly true are the particular choices each character makes and not the things that interrupt, as it were, from without, okay? I think the way he handles miracles and magic there is very interesting, though. If you reflect on the miraculous events in the Gospels, to some extent, with some exceptions, many of them occupy this sort of region of ambiguity between what nature is supposed to do but does not do because it's broken. The woman with a hemorrhage who saw 80 doctors, for example. They all reveal that at the heart of the work of the gospel is life, is healing, right? They piggyback on, map on, and lead to perfection the logic that life has already. I hope that makes a little bit of sense. I think that's a lot of the reason why Tolkien just doesn't use magic in an interrupting kind of way. Okay, and as a last example of what I mean by Tolkien having a kind of moral visionary realism, always coming back to our ability to see the real, is of course Samwise. He's my favorite character. Samwise Gamgee. So Sam, like all characters, has his own virtues and vices. Tolkien says that Sam's vice is his pride, and that he's judgmental and he's often really annoying. I don't know if that's a vice, but so be it. But within the context of the book, especially the last book, his inability to see the humanity of Sméagol behind the vileness of Gollum is really the essential failure that sets in motion Gollum's decision to betray the hobbits to Shelob. Sam's own unkindness, the incapacity he has to a kind of pity that Frodo himself has to learn, because many of you know, like he said, I wish Bilbo had killed him when he had the chance, and Gandalf's famous speech, who are you to deal out mercy and justice? Right, but that is, to deal out justice and judgment. Okay. All right. So his inability to pity hardens both Gollum and Frodo toward him. However, Sam is also correct about Gollum. He sees that Gollum is too far gone to evil. He's too far under the power of the ring for any one person or hobbit to redeem him. The problem, again, is that he does not see a place for mercy, as Frodo does. This may be because Frodo identifies with him as the narrative goes on experientially. Okay, but on the other hand, let's go back to Sam's virtue, which is that of charity. If you take a look at quotation 9 there, it says, Sam's virtue of love is really undertaken under a kind of vow that he takes under Gandalf's command at the start of the book, that is to be loyal. Okay, so he loves Frodo, and his love takes the form of a vow of a kind of loyalty, not quite obedience. So one of the reasons Sam is so important is that as the story unfolds, we are privileged to see Frodo through Sam's eyes. While Frodo suffers a sense of progressive unveiling as he approaches Mordor, he says nothing stands between him and a hostile will, that's quotation 9, that pierces all shadows of cloud and earth and flesh to see him. There's a lot of vision language, the sort of being exposed to the eye of the evil one. On the other hand, Sam's vision has a privileged place in the narrative. Sam sees him transfiguration-like, with a light that shines from within him that reveals the total dominance and giving over of himself to his mission. Quoting the Two Towers, Sam had noticed that at times a light seemed to be shining faintly from within, but now the light was clear and even stronger. At one point, he describes him as almost transparent. A little bit later, Return of the King, he says, Frodo is sleeping. It's this beautiful scene where Sam and Gollum note his appearance that he looks kind of like an old man, but in sort of a beautiful, peaceful way. And Sam says to himself, he's just talking to himself, he says, I love him. He says, he's like that. Sometimes it shines through somehow. I wish I could do a sort of Oxfordshire accent there. It's not a really clear sentence, you know, that what it refers to, but it seems to point to that light. So Sam's great virtue, again, is his capacity to love. And he is a good hobbit. It's true that humility is the hobbit virtue. And he's only victorious over the temptation of the ring because, I think I put that quotation down, Master Samwise knew in the core of his heart that he was just not large enough to bear such a burden. The one small garden of a free gardener was all his need and due. Okay? But whereas the eye sees Frodo in a way that communicates domination and hostility, Sam sees Frodo through the lens of charity. And thus he sees him more truly as he really is, as he becomes transparent to the sacrifice that he knows from very early on he's going to make. And Tolkien makes that very clear early in The Two Towers. Frodo knows that this will take his life. And it's just that faithful seeing that Tolkien says makes Sam the heroic figure of The Lord of the Rings. And that may be why Sam is the only character who's granted... It's kind of a moment where Tolkien cheats, but Sam is the only character in a way granted an image of the pattern. I don't know if you remember, there's this point, they're in Mordor, and they're dying of thirst, literally. And Sam prays to the Lady Galadriel, says, please show us water and light. And they find a river and a little trickle, and Frodo lays his head in his lap and sleeps. And Sam looks up, and all of a sudden the clouds, just a little break opens up in the clouds, and he sees the evening star. And I think I put this passage down in your handout. Yes, under 9 still. Says there, peeping among the cloud rack above, a white star. He saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart, and as he looked up out of the forsaken land, and hope returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and high beauty forever beyond its reach. Now, for a moment, his own fate, even his master's, ceased to trouble him. So it's Sam's renewed hope there. That glimpse, that privileged glimpse of grace that he's giving that allows him to propel the quest to its end. Okay, so I'm just going to, just one last short. So I talked about why he writes what he's writing and in the different modes that he's writing. They could be developed much more, but the particular way I'm trying to defend this is the way that he wants to link the chronology, the history, the geography of Middle-earth to our own. But then also the different ways that he signals explicitly that he uses tropes of vision and light to emphasize that, you know, there is a kind of moral progress going on here. And it's a moral progress in which we are implicated and we are asked to find ourselves. In a way, this all kind of avoids and dances around what Tolkien himself says is the real meat of the pattern or the story, and it's about sin. Tolkien prefers to talk about it in terms of time, in terms of finitude. Sin in Tolkien's mind is the unwillingness to just be the creature that one is. Okay, and elves manifest this one way. The great men of Gondor manifest it in their other way. You know, they build tombs instead of having families and try to extend their long life longer, so on and so forth. But the time stuff is interesting, but I just want to focus a little bit on a few aspects of evil and sin as this is playing out in Lord of the Rings, okay? Because Tolkien received, he was a great letter writer, and he answered pretty much all of them, but he received a number of letters from people that accused him of being a kind of manichae dualist. So a little bit of a Star Wars universe. I love Star Wars, but you know, you sort of have good and evil as these two equal principles that will perpetually be at war with one another. Okay, and Tolkien to some extent says, well, if we're talking about historical time, there's some truth to that. But he also says, and I think I wrote, that comes a little bit later, about absolute evil. He wants it to be really complicated. He wants evil to be understandable. He wants sin to be something that is intelligible, that we can enter into with sympathy, because it's really complicated, right? Being a moral agent is very complicated. So he doesn't want to simplify. Is evil, is the fall inevitable for Tolkien? In a sense, it is. He says, for any rational embodied being, temptation, especially when it's embodied in some powerful thing like the ring, is impossible to resist. Okay? So three very quick aspects of evil that he articulates defending his approach to this as the central, you know, the central problem that he's trying to articulate. First, he says, Tolkien says, evil is not an equal absolute principle in comparison to the good. He says it's parasitic, and thus it is banal. I think I put down in your sheet a quotation from his friend W.H. Auden, who said, evil has every advantage except for one. It is inferior in imagination. Good can imagine the possibility of becoming evil, hence the refusal of Gandalf and Aragorn to use the ring. But evil, defiantly chosen, can no longer imagine anything but itself. So the banality of evil is all throughout Lord of the Rings. It's consistently presented in terms of grayness or vagueness. When Frodo first puts the ring on, he's at that great tower of Amon Sul, which is called the Tower of Seeing, or one of the Seeing Stones used to be. He expects something awesome to happen. And when he puts it on, I think the film actually captures this nicely. It says he found himself in a region of grayness. Everything was really vague. I just think isn't that what like sin is supposed to kind of feel like? Anyway, that's my suspicion. But it's also, he feels depersonalized by being seen by the evil eye. In a really lovely passage, Saruman is described by Treebeard, a different example, as having a mind of metal and wheels. And this is necessary as part of his role in the plot, you know, his own desire to become a power. But in that same exchange, Treebeard describes Saruman as, once knowing him, he says, he has a face, but that face has become itself like windows in a stone wall, windows with shutters inside. So the effect of the desire for power and dominion, which is really the heart of evil, has this depersonalizing effect. Saruman has become his own inhabitation. He's poured all of himself into this thing, and he's lost himself. Secondly, evil or sin only becomes intelligible by virtue of that close connection to nature, which is very good. So Tolkien, here, he's very close to Thomas in suggesting that moral evil begins in the most basic, even biological appetites. Basic appetites, in one of his letters, Tolkien says, when these are wedded to the love of the world, a world in which we often feel our desire is in conflict, these desires fill us with anxiety and a sense of mortality, and a pathetic realization that the desires are just going to come back in a few hours. Every day, my hourly battle with hunger. As a result, our desire clings to the world, covets it, making it to be its own in the hope of being lord over some private creation. So what begins in the natural good of appetite, in light of the creaturely laws of finitude and mortality, as Tolkien calls them, that good appetite becomes a kind of rebellion against those same laws. And thus begins a desire, a new desire for power, in the hope that this will make my desires more effective. So illustrating Auden's point in the previous one about the banality of evil, the temptations that the ring offers to every character, they have to mimic a good aspiration proper to each, right? Sam is going to be the master gardener and the world's going to be beautiful. Gandalf will be the just version of Sauron. Everything will be fine. And Tolkien's point at the human level is nothing is really tempting. It doesn't look good. It's got to look good. That apple had to look really, really good, okay? All right, and third and finally, sin is not inevitable. And here's my last paragraph, okay? But when it is regnant, its power to finite creatures feels absolute. And I think that the reason that it has to be this way is that it is only by understanding the power of sin that the necessity, the primacy of grace has its moment. Okay. Tolkien goes back and forth. Was Frodo a hero? Was he not a hero? Did he fail? Did he succeed? He wants to say yes to all of those, okay? Tolkien is very clear. He thinks Frodo succeeded, but he also failed. But his failure was not a moral failure. A moral failure would be if his effort, his action, had fallen short of what he was capable of. But he's very clear. He said, Frodo did what he could, and he spent himself completely. However, he did fail because he came under the power of the ring. But even this, he says, is not truly moral failure, except to finite minds, who are unwilling to perceive the complexity of temptation in a very particular moment. It is not clear that Frodo could have done otherwise. So Tolkien wants us to be really sympathetic about the struggle with evil. Frodo, he says, in another letter, is honored and rewarded. He's truly heroic because the task he undertook in the beginning, he did it. But to the extent that he fails, Frodo merely illustrates Tolkien's observation that, quote, when we pray, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil, we are commanded to pray with respect to something that can actually happen. So the Lord's Prayer would not contain that phrase, were it not the case that we need to recognize that we are often helpless in the face of tremendous evil. This is what, I mean, this is St. Paul's epistle to the Romans, verse 7, right? I see the good, I can't do it. It's right there, okay? So theologically speaking, Frodo has to fail so that he can succeed only by the power of grace, which comes in the relatively unexpected form of being attacked by Gollum and Gollum biting off his offending member. I can't remember which finger the ring was on. So nevertheless, Frodo is saved, Tolkien says. He's really going back and forth here. And he's saved by that general humility, that mercy and sanctity that is bound up with the idea of his sacrifice. This is why also the ring has to be destroyed, because even if Gandalf were to wield it, it would become an instrument of power, because the lie of evil is precisely in the deceitfulness of what can really be accomplished by my power. See, that's the point, right? The moment of grace, as it were, is that moment of realizing, and this is why Frodo really is heroic in the end, is I can't do it. I cannot do the thing I'm asked to do. I need that help, okay? In a beautiful set of phrase, I don't know, I can't remember if I put this on your handout, Tolkien writes in one of his letters that true greatness of human spirit is not seen in power, but in its capacity for abnegation or self-denial. This is beautiful. So to conclude, and I mean this is the last, four sentences of the last paragraph, obviously I think the closing point that fits the mythological sort of project that Tolkien has is the principle that where sin abounds, grace abounds more. At the center of Tolkien's literary project is a conviction that good storytelling is the necessary pedagogical tool for reawakening the moral imagination of a people who are scarred by war, by violence, but then dulled and stultified by perpetual and excessive comfort. So I think that Tolkien is saying this is extremely relevant to us as well, that we can only receive revelation, we can only receive truth effectively if it is received with active, imaginative consideration of perennial human truths. The essential means for revelation being given in this way are given for Tolkien on the model of the church. The reality of sin, the primacy of grace, the abundant generosity of sacramental dispensation, but above all else, the flawed but essential fellowship of the body of Christ, which is why it is such a grace that you are here. So when the glorious and heroic deeds of Lord of the Rings come to completion in the lovely banality of the Shire or at the Owl Shop or wherever you guys go on a Monday night, you know, we have to consider not only, I'm back, this is real life, but we have to consider whether we've taken up the same journey of sacrifice and sanctification in the place in which we find ourselves. So thank you very much.